From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. I probably don't have to tell you this, but we are being inundated with news these days. In his new book, the philosopher Alain de Botton says more data flows into a typical newsroom in a single day than mankind as a whole would have generated in the 23 centuries between the death of Socrates and the invention of the telephone. This hum and this rush of the news, he says, has seeped into our deepest selves, and finding a moment of calm is a minor miracle. Today in the program, de Botton is joining us to offer some help with what he says all this news is doing to us, the envy, the terror, the frustration. He designed his book as a manual to complicate our habit a little and find another way to interact with the news machine. Join us after, well, after the news.
Hi, this is Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. Our online audio and podcasts are made possible by KUER and its listeners. If you like Radio West, help us make it happen. Become a sustaining member of KUER for as little as $5 a month. You can do that online at KUER.org. And thanks.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. For those of us who are really great surfers of the internet, the information age can seem old hat. But the philosopher Alain de Botton says these are early days. In his new book, he points out that for most of our history, news was too difficult or too expensive to collect and deliver, so we could focus on what was happening in town or in the countryside, and of course we had our inner lives to attend to. We didn't have to think about anything if we didn't want to. De Botton says we're really still at the dawn of understanding what kind of news we need to flourish as a society. What we get now is, of course, a massive torrent, headline after headline after headline, and it's hard to keep up. It's hard to make sense of it all. De Botton's book is a project that explores not only what news is right now and what's wrong with it, but what news could be and how we can consume it without becoming overwhelmed or detached. He's complicating our addiction, as he puts it, our habit. The book is called The News, A User's Manual. Alain de Botton is a philosopher and a writer. His books have looked at love, travel, work, and religion. He's co-founder of The School of Life, based in London, offers programs and classes in living well, and he's joining us today from the BBC in London. And Alain de Botton, welcome back. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Well, I'm going to ask you about how writing this book has changed your own news habits a little later. But let me ask you where you are, where you were as a news junkie. I guess you're as much of a news junkie as the rest of us?
Absolutely. I'm fascinated by news. I take it in from all channels. It's normally the first thing that I look at in the morning and the last thing that I look at night. And at a certain point, it struck me that this is bizarre, that it's a kind of addiction. And I wanted to try and make sense of my own addiction, to try and make sense of what I was really looking for, how I was using the news. And I was aware that I was abusing it in some ways, and that it's a very respectable form of addiction because it's so serious. You know, if you say, I'm just checking the news, right, Everyone thinks, oh, that's a very, very sensible thing to do.
You know, it's interesting. This is a kind of a theme in some way, this idea of just how, I guess it should have occurred to us before, but how strange all of this is, you know, all of this influx of information, because you point out it's so odd for us biologically as a species and where we are historically. It's really strange for us to be checking the news like this.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, for most of human history, history was assumed to be a wheel, a cycle. There was assumed to be a kind of cycle whereby things just kept coming around, like the seasons. And in around the middle of the 18th century, historians tell us, something fundamentally changed in the mind of man, and people started believing in this thing called progress, that things changed fundamentally from year to year. And that was really the sort of psychological moment of the birth of news, because once you imagine that actually everything changes, then you need to keep knowing the things that have changed. Of course, it may be the case that the things that have changed are not the most significant. It may be that the most important things in your life are actually the fairly static ones, your relationships, the day-to-day rhythm of family life, working life, etc., things that are not changing. But the whole spirit of the news is those are not the important things. There are no eternal verities. The news is very psychologically against religion, because religion is this stable set of truths. But the news says, no, 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 everything keeps changing. Every day there is a new headline. So all of this really fascinates me, and I wanted to try and get to grips with what it's doing to our inner lives.
Hegel, you pointed out, said that societies become modern when the news replaces religion as that central source of guidance. Is that where we are now?
Look, many people, of course, still follow religion, so don't get me wrong on that score.
No,
but the German philosopher Hegel pointed out very wisely that there is a shift when suddenly people start to get their sense of what is authoritative, what is right and wrong, what is shocking, what is good, not from the pulpit, but from the news. And I think that very many of us, whatever our supposed religious affiliations, do really look up to the news. I mean, think of the way that the news announces itself, through the sonorous, all over the world, the news, there's always a bit of music, isn't there, before, on the TV at least,
right.
Before the news headlines, sometimes on the radio too. It's sonorous, it's important, it's self-important, it's following often the traditional moments of prayer of religion. Matins has been transubstantiated into, the morning bulletin, Vespers, etc. And, and it never says this is some news. It says it's the news. It's not some news that people in a room have thought, could be important, and they've had a shot at kind of bringing it to your attention. It's called the news. And that's very authoritative. It makes an enormous claim. Not always, as we know from various sort of classic examples, not always a realistic or true claim.
And it demands deference. And you mentioned if we don't take part in these rituals, there's a sense of heresy there as well.
Yes. I mean, it's not a popular sport to knock the media, but it is obviously, very important. If you think of what revolutionaries do. If you want a revolution in Kiev or anywhere else, where's the first place you're going to drive your tanks or take your rebels? It's the TV station. Mm. It's the radio station. These are the places where our sense of what is real and what is important are shaped every day. We're speaking now on the airwaves. This is an incredibly important kind of resource. He or she who controls the media is controlling the minds of the population. So it is an unbelievably powerful resource. And I'm struck by the way that in school, we're taught how to read novels and taught a little bit about history, etc. But I don't know how it is in your part of the world, but certainly in the one where I'm come from, there is no systematic instruction in the peculiarities and oddities of the media machine. We grow into the news, and parents with young kids are always having slightly difficult moments when they're trying to tell their children, yeah, there's this thing called the news. Don't really look at it, or look at it like this or that. But it's tough. We don't systematically educate ourselves in this whole business. We're far more educated as to what we should eat, for example, than what we should consume. Yeah. In this trough of news.
You mentioned for all its commitments to providing information, the news, here's how you put it in the book, skillfully avoids training its eye on itself and the position it has in our lives. What do you mean by that? Is this deliberate?
Well, I mean, there's all sorts of conspiracy theories about the news that it's in fact in control of, a few rich white men who's sitting somewhere, trying to control all our minds. I think it's even spookier than that. If it was merely a conspiracy, that would be easy to crack. I think that there are all kinds of kind of widespread unconscious assumptions about what matters and what doesn't. And, we see it with things like the financial crisis. Why is it that despite all the incredible resources of the modern media, no one really saw it coming? Mm-hmm. It's unbelievable how many hours of, on the airwaves are spent to discussions, etc. And yet there are key questions that are oddly not part of the agenda. There is always an agenda in every society at any age, and there are questions that fit and questions that don't. And through an almost unconscious process of censorship, certain questions are squashed out. And we need to be really aware of that, because this is where societies have their weak moments, because even though there's free speech, there's not necessarily enough imaginative thought. And this is where the media runs into problems.
I want to come back to that point. But you ask all of these all kinds of intriguing questions in the book. One of them, what kind of world do we want to live in? And this one, what is the average person like? And I think if you look at the comment sections on most websites, for example, or if you think about mass entertainment or, you know, the popular stories that are trending, I think you'd be inclined to have a fairly, you know, low view of the average Brit or average American. But you say that we don't really have an answer to that question based on our own experience.
That's right. But, you know, it's a very basic but absolutely fundamental point. Most of us do not get our news about the world we live in from personal experience. We let other people make a selection for us. Mm. And so our sense of what it means to be, let's say, a British citizen or an American citizen is shaped by the news.
Yeah.
And that is why when our car breaks down on a lonely road on a dark night, we immediately think that we are going to be chopped into small pieces or fall into the hands of a paedophile or a weirdo or crazy, because that's what the news tells us that other people are like. And then, of course, we always make that fundamental realization, oh, people are quite nice, actually. Mm-hmm. Of course they're quite nice, because people are not necessarily the way they're presented in the media. The media remains anomalous. There would not be murders in the news, stories of murders all the time, if murders actually happened as frequently as we think they do. It's only because they're very weird, anomalous things that they end up on the news. I mean, again, it's a very basic point, but the news only reports on the unusual. And yet, if we spend all our time reading the news, what is actually unusual comes to seem normal. And that way, we get a fundamentally distorted picture of reality. And we have to keep reminding ourselves of this.
It's funny. It's like you're saying that we average Americans, we average Brits, we should give ourselves a bit of a break, because our impressions are formed in these sort of indirect ways through the media we're consuming, and maybe we're not like this at all.
Well, we just need to be aware of the way it all happens. I mean, take world news. Yeah. You know, take the news from abroad. You know, a fascinating thing about world news is that when you know the news will tell you 300 people died last week in the Democratic Republic of Congo, and you listen to a piece of news like that, and then you go and make a cup of tea or go to bed and fall asleep without any disturbance. So you hear about 300 people have died, and this does not disturb your sleep. This is extraordinary. Are we monsters? Are we so callous as to the fate of other people? You know, the dream of world news is, by knowing more, we will care more, and we will create the brotherhood of man. It hasn't happened. What's going on? The weird thing is, it comes down to art. Think of the average novel. A novel can tell you about the death of one character that never lived, and it makes you cry. The news tells you about the death of 300 people who have lived, and you don't bat an eyelid. What's going on? The difference is that the novel wants to grip your imagination, and the news isn't aware that it needs to do that. Mm. News is based on a notion that what is important is to gather the facts and to present the viewer with information. So it will tell you, someone's died, 300 people have died, there's been an earthquake, there's been a landslide, etc. And very often the raw facts leave us completely cold. Mm. I mean, why should I care about the death of 300 people whose lives I never even suspected? Because the news doesn't introduce us to the steady state of a place, it often has a really hard time engaging us with the anomalous event, the typhoon, the coup, the landslide, etc. And then people in news get very depressed, and they say things like, "Oh, no one cares. Everybody's racist. They don't care about abroad, etc." Mm. And I think I'm more sympathetic towards the viewer, the listener. I think that a lot of it has to do with the way the information is presented to us. We can care a lot about anyone at any time, alive or dead, real or imaginary, so long as it's presented to us in the right way. But that's not considered the job of the news. Journalists are not trained necessarily to do that. And that's a big theme for me.
Mm. This idea of providing context and perspective, I think, is important, because you mentioned in the book, it's impossible, as you put it, to nurture a sincere interest in any story when you're randomly dipping readers into a brief moment of a longer story, and then you pull them out again of this longer story. And you use the example of Tolstoy's epic novel Anna Karenina, for example.
That's right. I mean, the news is a little bit like being given a sentence or two, very occasionally, randomly, every few weeks, from a novel. It's almost like you're reading about 15 novels at the time, and then you get given one story, read one sentence, it's snatched away from you, then another one, etc. You know, if you want to keep a population kind of confused and accepting of the status quo, it's almost like you've got two options. The first, well practiced in places like North Korea, is to stop all news, to throttle, you know, the news pipe and to make sure that no one gets any news. The other darker kind of perspective is that really, if you want to keep people kind of confused and supine and not questioning things, just flood them with news. Give them so much news, they can't work out what on earth is going on or what they really care about anymore. And that's, you know, if you said to most people in America, in Britain, anywhere in the developed world, you said to them, what happened in the news last week? They'd go, oh, I don't really know anymore. An average bulletin might have 10 stories. You're listening to maybe 10 bulletins a day. The stories keep changing. I mean, our minds are not well attuned to kind of figuring this stuff out, to holding on to what's important. This makes it very difficult for politicians. They can't gather traction for certain issues because the audience just keeps getting fragmented and lost. The outrage that was generated last week has dissipated or changed focus this week, etc. So that makes it very hard to govern and to lead a nation.
One of the things you write about, this is interesting, is, you know, how journalism is supposed to be neutral and is supposed to be fair and dispassionate, you know, just dispensing facts. And this is what you call the problem with facts. The opposite of facts is bias. And in the book, you write about how maybe we shouldn't be a bit more generous toward the idea of bias, bias in its pure form.
That's right. Look, I mean, bias has a really bad name in serious news organizations. And bias is associated with low news organizations like, say, you know, Fox News or very, you know, very right-wing bias, left-wing bias. And people are, you know, serious-minded people are appalled by the idea of bias. And they think, you know, good news organizations, perhaps NPR, BBC, etc., they are serious because they're not shoving ideology down your throat. The BBC, where I come from, has a very high reputation, and it never tells you overtly what to think. It just says, this has happened, and then if there's a contentious issue, it'll have one person. I mean, I'm not exaggerating, really, but literally, if they have an issue like genital mutilation, they'll have one person who's pro-genital mutilation and one person who's against genital mutilation, and they'll just play two people off one another. They'll never say what they think because they don't think that's the job of the news. And the only time they ever had an opinion on anything was apartheid. They decided after much soul-searching that apartheid was a bad thing. But ever since then, they do not express opinions. And many news organizations are like this. And the view is this will unfairly influence the audience. Now, my sense is that I can see where they're coming from, but I worry that if we are simply deluged with facts, with information, but no guidance is given, we're often in trouble. And I think the point is, you know, most of us have a very good detector for bias that we don't like. We're not, you know, we don't keel over and kind of collapse in the face of someone giving an opinion. Slightly sort of patronizing for people to go, you know, if we gave you anything biased. So what we need is not so much no bias, but good bias. Yeah. And we need a variety of biases. And I think somehow the shrill voices on the left and the right, it's almost like that's the only bias we know. In fact, there are many different kinds of biases we could apply.
So bias is introducing, as you say in the book, this scale of values by which to judge ideas and events. So again, it's about offering context.
It's a value system, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you know, if someone tells you, you know, President Obama is weighing up whether to allow for, you know, a gas pipeline to go from the tar sands of Canada down to the Gulf of Mexico, and you know, and you present that simply as a factual story, it's going to be very hard for the audience to kind of know what to think. So it's quite useful to have somebody going, look, I think that's a great thing, or I think that's a bad thing, and here's why, and this is the way it works, etc. So I think we need interpretation, and you know, it doesn't necessarily have to be a bad thing. Most of us are very good at working our way through biases.
Alain de Botton is with us. He's joining us from the BBC in London. His book is The News, A User's Manual. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West and Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the philosopher and writer Alain de Botton is back with us. In his latest book, he's trying to make sense of the torrent of news that comes at us on the internet. Forget religion, Debaton says. It's news that's our central source of guidance in the digital age, and it's the most significant force setting the tone of public life these days. But why are we so interested in the love lives of celebrities or the corruption of politicians? Why does the important stuff seem so boring? Well, Debaton thinks he knows why, and he sees his book as a kind of user's manual to bring some measure of sanity and calm to our interactions with this news machine. The book is called The News, A User's Manual. You describe boredom as a new challenge, a new responsibility, but you put a different, I have to say, kind of a generous spin on the idea of being bored. You point out that what's often going on when we feel bored, you know, with a headline is that our brains are just confused about where we're supposed to sort of put this story. It's about where it belongs on the shelf, is I think how you put it.
That's right. I mean, you know, many news stories kind of don't necessarily flag up how they could be interesting to us. You know, if somebody tells you, I don't know, there was a fight in a small town on a Saturday night, you kind of go, yeah, well, whatever. But if somebody were to say, okay, look, this little moment, this little fight is actually part of a bigger story. It's about how a modern liberal society, without any strict rules about behavior, how it's learning to cope with the kind of vital, destructive, aggressive energies of young people, and how that's colliding with alcohol, etc. You know, you could zoom out from a little story and put it in an interesting context. And I think a lot of the work of the news should be to do that for us. A lot of what we're presented in the news is basically undigested. And if we get bored, it's because it's either not been flagged up correctly, or it's not been tied up with the bigger issue we can care about. So very often the news leaves us feeling that we're sort of indifferent, bad people. You know, we were talking about foreign news, world news, and the way that can sometimes leave us feeling, you know, asking ourselves, am I a horrible person because I don't care? No, you know, it's very challenging to be asked to care about information which in a previous age would have gone straight to the government. You know, let's remember that the origin of news is specialized information for branches of government. That's how it started. And now a very generous democratic impulse means that that news is given to everybody. So the news that would formerly have gone to, you know, the Secretary of State is now going to an electrician in Iowa or, you know, a housewife in Florida. And that's great. That's terrific. But there's just going to need to be a bit more interpretation, a bit more working through. Because, you know, the natural response is to go, why are you telling me this? Why do I care that, you know, three Chinese warships have just left the Vietnamese coast? I mean, what am I supposed to do with this kind of information? And the kind of the polite view is, well, it's important, so we're telling you. You know, a very fair enough response would be to go, but I don't know where to put this in my mind. Yeah. I just don't know. And the news needs to help us with that.
They need to be the librarians in some way.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, look, there's a real hierarchy in news in terms of the kind of serious, important stuff. And then, of course, there's the low news that people are gripped by, but then they sort of feel, oh, I'm not really allowed to be interested in that. I mean, take, you know, the stuff that really flies when you put it on the headlines are murders, you know, celebrity divorce stories, etc. And, you know, many of us think, I'm kind of gripped by this, but I know I shouldn't be, you know, I shouldn't be gripped by news of a plane crash and, you know, many are dead. You know, am I a horrible person for caring about this? And in my book, I point out that, you know, it's been the stuff of great works of tragedy from, you know, the get-go that we as human beings need to listen to news about tragedy, because this is very important information about the way life goes. And it's just so happens that there's this kind of almost snobbishness, like, oh, you know, car crashes, oh, that's not serious news, or, you know, murders, that's not serious. But, you know, let's remember, what was Sophocles writing about? He was writing about murders, domestic murders, and in his hands, we're prepared to respect them. But when it comes to, you know, the news telling us, we think, oh, you know, serious people think, oh, well, no, you know, that's not important. So I point out in my book that, you know, when we're picking up on news about a car crash or whatever, what are we doing? We're looking for the meaning of life. Very often, life, you know, when we think life is eternal, when we kind of get lazy about what our priorities are, we forget that we've only got a very short span of time on this earth. And it really pays to think about how prone we are to accident, how quickly it could all come to an end. And I think when suddenly we're gripped by this news of people who were going about their daily life and then suddenly they got into a fire or crashed or something, we're sort of feeling our way to some really big questions. And I think it should be the task of the news, or at least the task of us as audiences of the news, to be aware that there's some invitations there to some pretty serious thoughts. And it's not just ghoulishness. It's not just rubbernecking. It's important stuff, the kind of the low bits of the news. I reject this kind of low-high categorization.
You mentioned how when journalism emerged, it had this noble promise that it's going to alleviate ignorance and raise the intelligence of the people. But there are those, Flaubert is one that you mentioned, who thought journalism was in fact making us stupid. I wanted you to talk about his beef, because he figured newspapers were proposing to do the thinking for us and that this was not good for intelligence, not good for curiosity.
Well, look, I mean, again, it's something very basic about the news. The news is a mass medium. So, you know, a big newspaper outlet and a big radio show will have audiences in the millions. And what it will be doing is laying out lines of thought, perspectives that will be of appeal to millions of people. So it'll suggest how millions of people might think about an issue. And in a way, that's great. And on a good day, that means that millions of people are properly informed and their minds are raised, etc. And on a bad day, what we do is we abandon our skepticism, our critical faculties, to news organizations that maybe haven't worked it out. And again, I come back to the financial crisis. You know, what went on there was that there was a kind of dominant agenda about what it means for a country to be doing well economically. And there were a few voices going, well, I'm not sure we agree with that story about, how the country is doing well. Maybe it's not doing well, because if you measure it according to some other, metrics, etc. But those voices were drowned because it's mass, it's a mass medium. And those voices didn't have a place in the mass medium. And so the writer Flaubert, writing in the 19th century, at the time when newspapers were first becoming popular, pointed out that there is real danger for society when people develop their opinions by the millions, because you can suddenly get a whole population that falls into a delusion at once. Mm. So at its best, we're informed, and at its worst, we collectively blind ourselves to very important truths.
So this is what you mean when you write about that we expect all of these big issues to be capable of drastic compression, is how you put it, to be sort of summed up in some big way.
Well, I think, the news sets an agenda around certain topics. So if you think of education, for example, the debate around education tends to be about how to fund it, the role of government, the role of private enterprise, teacher performance assessments, classroom behavior. Those tend to be, as it were, the questions on the agenda. If you raise another kind of question like, what's our education for? Is it making us happy? Is it the job to make us wise? If relationships are some of the central stumbling blocks in many people's lives, how come we don't learn about them systematically? Shouldn't that be part of the curriculum, etc.? If you raise those sort of questions, very quickly you're in kind of oddball territory. It's very easy to label yourself as an oddball. Similarly, on the economic agenda, if you raise certain questions, there's some standard questions around, interest rates and, some of the big moves the government is making around unemployment, etc. But if you say things like, how should income be distributed? What is the ownership of companies? How could that be made fairer, etc.? You're quickly in the realm of things that seem sort of fantastical or radical, etc. So it's just good to be aware of how, in a very free society, our minds nevertheless follow certain rails of thought that are remarkably constrained, even within an apparently very free system of information.
Mm. There's a section in the book I wanted to ask you about. You write about how, over time, artists and poets like William Carlos Williams, were afraid that the news was stripping out poetry and stripping out empathy in the world. But you write this, you say this idea that this equation that poetry is life and news is death is not a permanent law, that there is a way to mix them, you can have news that has details, that has what, dare I say, poetry in it as well.
Yeah, look, traditionally there's been a bit of a war going on between artists and journalists. Artists take themselves to be the, you know, the true purveyors of the human condition. They're the ones who understand, who move us, etc. And the journalists are, you know, just the kind of at the grubbier end of things. Now, I reject that. I think that you know, if you look at the great works of art, they're often based on news stories. You know, what is Anna Karenina but a kind of blown up version of a little story that Tolstoy happened to read in the newspaper? Ditto with Flaubert and Madame Bovary. So many of the great stories of our age and previous ages have had their origins in little daily events. So the challenge of the news is to try, and obviously, you know, you can't have Sophocles or Shakespeare or Tolstoy in the newsroom writing the news. But I think a greater awareness of the unbelievable complexity and interest in so-called small stories, in news stories. The news needs to learn a little bit some of the lessons of art in order to become, in order to really fulfill its promise, which is to properly move us, dignify us, educate us, etc. Because at the moment, you know, we've often got this sort of strange thing that the news has got the power. The news has got the satellites, it's got the studios, it's got the huge audiences, and yet it's not necessarily doing anything with them that is particularly kind of profound. And meanwhile, you've got, you know, the poets and the artists, and their output is read by only a very, very few people. And, you know, it's an odd kind of disjuncture that you know, I was, while researching this book, I read quite a little bit about the 19th century and the way in which news from foreign countries used to be met with unbelievable excitement. You know, if somebody went to South America and returned to your country, they would be, you know, a star. People would want to know it, etc. Nowadays, we get news from anywhere. And if you look at the traffic figures, people are so uninterested, unbelievably uninterested in news from Africa, from South America, from parts of Asia. This stuff does not rate at all. How is that possible? You know, how come we've become these kind of global provincials? Again, I think some of the blame lies in the way this material is presented to us. We are not congenitally, you know, uncurious. We're not, you know, congenitally bored by stuff that goes on outside of our borders. We just need it to be delivered to us in a way that isn't just an information-based way. As I said before, if you simply lay out the facts in front of people, the danger is that those facts will not sink deeply enough into their hearts and minds.
You asked this question in the book. Why is it that the news is telling us all of this? And we'll talk about darkness, because this is a section you write about. And the answer is often, you know, we have a duty as journalists. And look, we're not making this stuff up. But you say something provocative. You say, well, that's not necessarily true. What do you mean by that?
Look, I think there's a real issue about what we need to hear. And it's a complaint that many people have made. People say things like, the news is full of bad stuff. Why does it need to be full of bad stuff? Couldn't the news be a bit more cheerful? And every now and then people, you know, will start up a more cheerful program or focus on some cheerful news, etc. I think the way to cut through this issue between, you know, dark news and cheerful news is slightly different. I think we need to ask ourselves, what's the point of news? And my view, and I describe it somewhere in the book, I say, look, the point of news ultimately is that it should be information which helps the individual and the nation to flourish, to be the best version of itself, right? That's what I think the news is. If you use that as the criteria, that can help to guide you, as an editor, say, of a news program, as to what news stories are important and what news stories are not. Because it's not necessarily going to be the case that people just need to hear cheerful stuff, because if they keep hearing cheerful stuff, there are some very important things that they're going to be missing out on, and they need to be informed of the dark stuff. Similarly, if people only hear the dark stuff, they may fall into a kind of version of depression, which is not necessarily going to be good for the flourishing of the individual or the nation. And so I think we need to ask first and foremost, what should the bulletin really be trying to do? What could it be doing? And that should guide whether it's a cheerful story or sad story. I don't think we should simply say, you know, more sad or more cheerful.
Right.
Ultimately, it's the needs of the nation. And too often, I think journalists fall into this trap of thinking, well, it isn't news until it's very upsetting. And that may be true, but that's not the criteria. It's not because it's upsetting that it should be news. That shouldn't be the criteria.
Well, you say there should also be this duty to to train and direct society's capacity for pride and resilience and hope. And you have this particular interest, I know, in architecture, which you use as an example of how we can showcase the positive, I guess it is.
Look, I think ultimately what the news helps to do is to create a nation in people's minds. So when people go, you know, I'm an American, what does that mean? They will not be using the points of reference of people that they know in their immediate vicinity. They will be thinking about a picture of the nation given to them by the news. And that is an enormous responsibility. In other words, the news has the power to create in the audience's imagination this thing called the United States. Because the United States does not exist in people's direct personal experience, or people are not encouraged to think that is necessarily their nation. They take their cue as to what the nation is from the news. That's an enormous responsibility because the nation is, of course, so complex. There's a billion stories you could tell. So which ones are you going to tell? And what is your sense of how you're leaving the audience? And, you know, it's very possible to despair of one's country. And some of that despair is going to be a bit unfair because it's a selection of stories that you've made. And, you know, I think people in news need to be aware of that. They are literally creating in people's minds the feeling of whether it's worth carrying on with this nation, whether there's any hope in it. And, you know, that isn't an argument for kind of boosterism or, you know, simple, cheerful, good news. It's just an argument for saying, what are we trying to do here with this information? Did I need to hear about that murder right now? Is that really important? Might there be other things as well? Because you've told me 7 bits of bad news. I'm now having to leave the house. I've had a bit of a difficult time with my spouse. And frankly, I'm prepared to give up on the human condition at this point. Is that the task of the news? Has the news done its job well, necessarily? And that's up for debate. And I think we should be aware of falling into a kind of knee-jerk sense of, yep, you know, it's grim, therefore it's news, and that's the bulletin.
Alain de Botton is with us, his book, The News, A User's Manual. And we need to take another brief break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, Alain de Botton is with us. We're talking about his latest book. It's called The News, A User's Manual, and he's joining us from London. I wanted to ask you about comments sections. It's not something you spend a lot of time in the book, but what do you make of the comments sections on websites? I mean, there can be some fairly interesting stuff, but there's often a lot of vitriol, a lot of hate, a lot of pettiness. What do you make of that? What is that a reflection of in terms of us?
Look, I think it's fascinating, and we're, you know, the first generation to be grappling with this, so it's definitely worth a moment's thought. Look, you know, most people out there are pretty nice, and if you meet them, they're very friendly, and, you know, on a good day, you know, we're among some nice folks. The problem is you then scroll down on the website, you go below the line, as they call it, and you see some extraordinary stuff. Mm-hmm. I mean, it seems as though everybody's insane, crazy, you know, shouting in a rage, etc. What is going on? Look, I think it's a little bit like journals. You know, when you've hit a crisis at home and you go up to your bedroom and you start writing your journal and you say, I want to end it all and I hate everybody and isn't this not worth it, and etc. And, you know, the tears are mingling with the ink and, you know, it's an emotional moment. I'm not just being autobiographical. Anyway, you then put the journal away. Mm. And it's very important that people don't read this, because if they did, they would really have a hard time kind of looking at you in quite the same way again. That stuff should stay private. And I think in a way, the eruptions that we're seeing in the comments pages, some of them have that quality of a journal entry. Mm. And just like a journal, it's really important sometimes not to read them, because they don't necessarily represent the whole truth about human beings. They are, you know, eruptions of momentary rage and disappointment. I mean, to come to the kind of deeper issue, why is there so much anger? I think the news is partly responsible. Mm. The news is permanently involving us in cycles of hope, which are then dashed by cruel disappointment. So it will say the politician, you know, is going to solve everything. He or she's going to be elected. It's going to be wonderful. Huge excitement around this new politician. And then lo and behold, the politician can't do that much. People get furious. We thought it was going to change. There's a new invention. People are going to think, this is going to really revolutionize my life. Actually, a lot of things carry on the same, etc. So because the news needs to keep us fascinated in the future, it needs to suggest that things are going to be very different in the future. Then, of course, the reality comes along. And of course, the future is, it's a lot like the past. And that means that things are changing very slowly on a decade-long cycle, not a sort of hour-by-hour or year-by-year basis that that news teaches us to expect. And that leads to impatience and rage. So one thing the news never does is to calm us down in any way. It doesn't, when there's a big storm, tell us, we'll get through it. The lights went out, but, they'll come back on. And, there's been a flood, but, we'll get through this. We've been, there's been an economic crisis, but we've been here before. We've had dips of, 5-10% before. We'll survive. The news never tells us this. It is permanently trying to keep us excited because, of course, it's got an imperative to keep us wanting to come back. And so it doesn't do us that basic service of saying, as a kind of good Stoic philosophy would say, it'll pass. Rome fell, but 600 years later, those guys were almost back to where they'd started. The news is catastrophic. The only area where it really makes us permanently hopeful is the area of medicine, where you'll know how it is in the news. Permanent, breakthroughs about to be announced in science. The news is, of course, the kind of progeny of the modern world and is very connected up with science and the idea that we're kind of racing towards a beautiful new future where science will solve everything. And so the news is permanently informing us of new developments and giving us health tips. Maybe if we drink more wine or less wine or take an aspirin or wear special socks or eat walnuts or whatever, things will change. And then, of course, they don't really. But it doesn't tell us the big basic things like you are mortal, you will die, everyone you love will die. It's okay. This has always happened this way. That's the cycle of life. The news doesn't want to tell us this.
It's interesting. You have a very particular strategy, it seems, for the ideal news outlet of the future. I mean, we mentioned this early on that we're still in the early days of trying to figure out what the news is that we need, the dawn of understanding about what we need to flourish properly. What does it look like then, this ideal paper, this ideal news organization? Or do they all come in a story that they're written a certain way, or that there are various sidebars? Yeah. Do you know what I mean?
Well, look, I mean, I think, throughout the book, I'm keeping that question alive. Yeah. What would a better news world look like? And obviously, there's lots about the news that's fantastic, so don't get me wrong on that score, but I think there's room for improvement. So I look at a number of areas. I look at, say, foreign news reporting, think, how could we improve this stuff? How could we make it more visceral, more enticing? I look at economic news. How could we, as a nation, stay alive to some of the big questions around, how we share the pool of money that's out there? How could that be more a part of the day-to-day, part of the, what we call financial economic news reporting, business news? How could that be part of how we look at that kind of news? I look at, celebrity news. Mm. A lot of serious people hate celebrity news. Why are we finding out about Miley Cyrus all the time? What does this matter to good people? I ask myself, how could, a good society should have role models, should have famous people that we read and hear about. How could they be the right ones? How could news editors think about the role of celebrity, anointing? What does it mean to make somebody famous? The news is often quite nasty towards famous people as well. How could we work out our levels of envy? Because there's often, fascinating degrees of envy that are directed towards famous people. How can we clear our minds around that issue? So all the time, yes, I'm asking those big kind of utopian questions, because I think we can do better. Some people have said, the future of news is personalized news. And Google News does this, of course, for us. If you've been on Google News, you've got little buttons that will tell you whether you want more sport or less sport or more foreign news or less foreign news, etc. And many people have said that is the future of news, a kind of personalized news service. And I spent some pages thinking about this. What would that mean, personalized news? It's a beautiful idea. I mean, the idea is really that you would one day have exactly the news that you need. I mean, that's a fantastic thing. So rather than being bored or taken astray by news. The news would be for you and would help you to know everything that you need to know. The problem is that the problem comes in the programming of this kind of news computer, because you have to know yourself really well to know what you need. And most of us don't quite understand ourselves well enough to do the programming, you know, that Google is offering us or whatever. So I kind of look at some of the kind of paradoxes there.
If our curiosity starts to spin in the soft slush of data, as you put it, what are we supposed to do about it? I mean, beyond the responsibility of a news organization to provide better, you know, signposts, those kinds of things. What do you say to those of us who are addicted? How are we supposed to? Are we supposed to limit the amount of news we're exposed to, or are we supposed to focus differently? What do you think about that?
Look, I think there are a number of strategies. I think, and this is such an odd recommendation, but it's only because we're living in this very new and strange world. We need to take new Sabbaths. We need to take periods of time when we are not listening to what other people are saying. And that used to be very easy, and now it's very hard because of things like Twitter and because of our mobile phones. Let's remember nowadays that most news is consumed by Americans on their mobile phones. That is the number one way in which people are hearing about stuff. And that thing is everywhere. It follows us into the bedroom. It follows us, you know, everywhere. And so we need to take time, conscious time, to say, I am not going to look at this infernal machine. I will put it aside and I will do some of my own checking out of my own reality. I'll ask myself questions, what I think. I will explore myself. And the news is the best form of distraction ever invented, partly because it's so prestigious.
Yeah.
You know, if you're sitting around and someone says to you, you know, hey, what are you doing? And you say, well, I'm listening to the news, or I'm checking out the news. People go, oh, well, that's very serious. You know, you must carry on. If you say, well, you know, I'm sitting around because I'm thinking about, well, something that a friend told me and something that happened when I was 12 and a kind of funny shape in the sky as the clouds are moving along. People go, yeah, come on, go and do the washing up. I mean, this seems like a waste of time. So the news is incredibly prestigious. And so it squeezes out other forms of quite necessary analysis of, well, really our own problems. You know, this particularly comes to the fore when there's a big catastrophe, big national catastrophe, and suddenly we're worrying, you know, there's an aeroplane that's come down at LaGuardia. You know, did the fire crew get there in time? You know, how's the foam doing? Did it calm down the engines, etc.? And, you know, we suddenly are behaving as though we are manning the rescue operation there in New York City. And we're not. We have to remember that. We're, you know, 1,000 miles away and we have other priorities. It's very hard to balance, you know, what we should take seriously in our own lives versus what we should take seriously in the life of the community, etc. And it's worth thinking about, because if we're not careful, we get swept along and we think, you know, there's some story about a general who may or may not have committed adultery and, you know, this is dominating our thoughts, and et cetera. And then we've got to think, you know, we are not that man. This is not our life. So in a way, what we require is both a capacity to properly immerse ourselves in the lives of others and to draw out the true morals and the, you know, the interest, and at the same time to step back and, you know, value our own experiences, our own thoughts, and the kind of the experiences we need to have on our own outside of the media machine. And that's a difficult balance to get right.
Our inner examination, as you say, the news is a jealous adversary. I want to have you read a section in the book, if you would, because you talk about that, you know, we will have nothing substantial to offer anyone else as long as we haven't first mastered, as you put it, the art of being patient midwives to our own thoughts. Read this section, if you would.
That's right. It comes at the end of the book, and I say, we need long train journeys on which we have no wireless signal and nothing to read, where our carriage is mostly empty, where the views are expansive, and where the only sounds are those made by the wheels as they click against the rails in rhythmical succession. We need airplane journeys where we have a window seat and nothing else to focus on for 2 or 3 hours but the tops of the clouds and the constant presence, only meters away in the inconceivable cold, of one of the engines slung under the broad ash-grey wing. We can't find everything we need to round out our humanity in the present. There are attitudes, ideas, modalities of feeling and philosophies of mind for which we have to journey backwards across the centuries or through the corridors of reference libraries, past forgotten museum cabinets filled with rusting suits of medieval armour, along the pages of second-hand books marked with the annotations of their now deceased owners. We need to balance contact with the ever-changing pixels on our screens with the pages of heavy, hardback books that can proclaim, through their bindings and their typefaces, that they have something to say that will still deserve a place in our thoughts tomorrow. We need relief from the news-fueled impression that we're living in an age of unparalleled importance, with our wars, our debts, our riots, our missing children, our after-premiere parties, our IPOs, and our rogue missiles. We need, on occasion, to be able to rise up into space in our imagination, many miles above the mantle of the earth, to a place where that particular conference and this particular epidemic, that new phone and this shocking wildfire will lose a little of their power to affect us, and where even the most intractable problems will seem to dissolve against the eons of time to which the view of other galaxies attests.
Let me ask you this finally. This is hard for some to hear, for journalists, for people who consume news. How are people reacting so far to your ideas?
Well, it's interesting. You know, some journalists I've managed to upset quite deeply and personally. And they've said things like, you know, we are an embattled industry. Our finances are not going well. People are not paying for news. You know, and you're coming along and you're telling people to stop reading news sometimes, to be more skeptical of us. You know, you're really rattling, you know, the whole institution. To which my answer is, look, I'm not responsible to people in news organizations. I've got great friends who work there. But ultimately, what I'm interested in is the audience, we the audience. And I think the issue is very similar to food production. Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, you know, the media is a mass industry like big farming, etc. And we, the consumers, need to wise up sometimes about what's going on and just make sure we're eating healthily when it comes to that media diet. And that will involve sometimes a little bit of skepticism about what journalists are telling us and how they go about their business, because they're very happy to keep us frightened, scared, sometimes confused. It's all part of their job, and we understand it, and there's a logic to it, but it's not necessarily the logic that we, the consumers, need. So we just need to keep our wits about us as we do that thing, which is navigate through the kind of plethora of news that we're being given every day.
Alain de Botton, his book is called The News, A User's Manual, joined us from the BBC in London. And Alain de Botton, thank you very much for the time.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.